This is Book Public from Texas Public Radio. I'm Yvette Benavides. On this episode, we turn to Ruth Ozeki's The Typing Lady, a collection that reflects on writing as both physical work and a way of thinking. At first glance, the stories in this collection focus on the act of typing. Hands move across keys. Language appears in real time. Paper and text become part of the process. But beneath that, Ozeki is asking larger questions about memory, identity, and how stories take shape before we fully understand them. What does it mean to put something into language? And how does writing change the person doing it? Ozeki's known for layered storytelling and close attention to language. In The Typing Lady, she slows things down. She asks us to notice how thought becomes text. The stories resist urgency, even as they explore urgent questions. As with the act of typing on a typewriter, they focus on repetition, hesitation, and revision, the moments when meaning is still forming. Writing here is not a finished product. It's a process. It happens in stages with pauses, corrections, and returns. The collection also moves between autobiography and fiction without fully committing to either. That space in between is important. The Typing Lady feels like both a character and a presence, possibly the author, possibly a projection. That uncertainty raises questions about authorship. Who is speaking when words appear on the page? And how much of the self is created through the telling? Ozeki also keeps attention on the physical side of writing, the hands on the keyboard, the rhythm of the typing, the pauses between sentences that shape meaning as much as the words themselves. Writing here is not abstract. It is grounded in process and detail. The work asks us to notice what we often miss, small choices, revisions, and the slow building of meaning. The Typing Lady treats storytelling as a way of organizing experience. Writing is less about fixed answers and more about attention, how we notice, remember, and shape what happens to us. In Ozeki's work, typing becomes an act of care, a way of holding language long enough for meaning to emerge. You'll see what I mean in this wide-ranging interview about writing stories, publishing a collection at age 70, the supremely skilled ways she can write a range of characters in diverse places, the trunk full of ideas around stories and loss, and of course, typing. I spoke to Ruth Ozeki about her most recent book, The Story Collection, The Typing Lady, and Other Fictions. The Typing Lady. I love the cover. I love everything about this book. What do people ask you? And what do you say when they ask you, what's the book about?
You know, the Typing Lady is sort of, well, The Typing Lady and Other Fictions makes it clear, makes a couple things clear. It makes it clear that it's a short story collection and that there is a character named The Typing Lady and that what's to come is fictional. Of course, there's a kind of there's a little bit of playing around that I'm doing there, because The Typing Lady is actually a character from my last novel, The Book of Form and Emptiness. She's just a minor character. She sits in a library. She's, you know, typing away on her laptop, and she's observing everything that's going on around her, sort of observing the primary characters, and then writing down, making notes about their behavior. And the joke is, of course, that the Typing Lady looks a lot like me. And in fact, she's kind of like my Hitchcock moment. She's an auto-fictional character, you know, sort of based on me, appearing in the novel. So this Typing Lady in this book, who starts the collection, her story is kind of the first in the collection, is also a kind of play off of that, you know, even though it suggests that's all fictional. You know, there's a little bit of hesitation about whether this is true. So in terms of, I think, what it's about typing. It's about writing. I think there's a theme of loss that goes through a lot of the stories and the way that we make sense of loss through storytelling, through writing, and through typing.
You do write about writers writing. What is it that keeps you coming back to this idea of writers as characters, what is it that you think you're exploring? Is there something bigger here about how we need to make meaning through stories? I love stories that are about writers. Not everybody does. I don't know if you know this, but I do. I love stories that are about writers. What brings you back to that?
Sure. I mean, I think, as a writer, of course, it's a world that I know very well. But it's also, I think it's kind of more than that. It's not just about the way, I mean, I think it's about the way that we use creativity, that we use, in this case, storytelling, but any kind of creative activity to make sense of, of our lives, and also, to make meaning, I think is what is the word that you use, to make meaning in our lives. And this is something that I've been aware of ever since I was quite a little kid. When I was I've written about adolescence, and I've written about troubled adolescence, and the way that they contend with the trouble in their life is through this kind of relationship through language with somebody else, right? Or some other person or some other thing, right? And so in a way, I think it's also just about relationship. It's the way that relationships, in this case, developing through writing, but the way that relationships can really help us and pull us out of some pretty dark spaces.
Oh, so I'm so glad you mentioned this idea of adolescence and the way that you write them. I was really struck in this collection by many of the protagonists. They're young people, and they're in this threshold of change. Stories like The Anthropologist's Kid, Feelings, Ships in the Night. These characters are, they're still very naive. They're still very innocent, but we're able as readers to already glimpse something about their future selves, or something that's intimated about who they will become. So I like this idea about how drawn you are to writing these characters during these moments before life completely disappoints them. I just love that about these stories. I want to ask you about typewriters.
Uh-huh.
What is it? What is it about typewriters that they're so appealing. They're so good. I don't know what it is.
You find it so too, right?
Yes, I do.
You find them very appealing. I can tell.
my mom was a legal secretary for many years. So as a kid growing up in the 70s, I would see my mom sitting at the typewriter, and I didn't see it as an object of drudgery or work or something terrible. I saw it as something exciting. And my dad was a teacher, and he loved office supplies, and he loved typing. And I don't know if that's where my affinity for it comes from, but there's just something about a typewriter. Can you talk about it?
I agree. I could not agree with you more. I mean, my history with typewriters goes way back, again, like yours, to when I was really quite a little child. Both my parents were, both of them were teachers, professors. They were both, they were both writers. They both had typewriters. And, some of my earliest childhood memories are of lying in bed and listening to typing. And to me, that was always, it was both soothing and also exciting. They would, they always let me, I think ever since I was really little, they let me type on their typewriters. And so it was something that, it was an experience that I equate early on with this feeling of grown-upness, of power, of creativity. I felt, it was the first place where I felt like a real writer sitting in front of a typewriter and pecking away at the keys. I think my mother must have taught me how to touch type pretty early on, because I've always had that skill. I remember in college, when we got electric typewriters for the first time, and that just seemed like such an amazing advance in technology, but one of the things that's interesting about typewriters, I think, and that, well, I think there's many things that are interesting about typewriters, but one of the things that's interesting is that typewriters are durable. They last. In fact, they outlast us. And computers are not like that. I mean, think of how many computers you've gone through in your life, right? Mm-hmm. You've probably gone through many computers. I know I have. And but typewriters go through us, right? They survive multiple owners because the technology is so robust and so durable. And so that always intrigued me. I mean, I always, you know, it's a little fanciful, but I love to think of, you know, the typewriters as carrying the stories of the people who typed on them before they came into my life. I mean, I confess, I collect typewriters. So but these typewriters have been owned by many people before me. And I just can't help but think that the typewriters have some sort of memory of all of the things, the letters, the stories, the, you know, invoices, the whatever it is, you know, that the letters of complaint, you know, that were typed on them. I know that's, you know, I know that's not probably true, but I don't know, maybe, who knows? So there's something kind of magical about that. And then the other thing I think, especially for manual typewriters, is that, you know, it takes a lot of effort to push down the keys. You really need to use the muscles of your fingers to type properly on a manual typewriter. And it's just not something that we do anymore. So when I first started, you know, getting typewriters and typing on them, I was really surprised at how physical it was, right? I was aware of using my body to write. And that was kind of thrilling, you know? It also meant that my mind had to slow down so that my fingers could keep up, right? Mm-hmm. And that was also very interesting because it made me realize how when I type on a computer, very often my mind is you know, is really traveling fast. And because my fingers can, you know, because I can type very quickly, it's a very different sensation to write on a manual typewriter than it is, you know, to write on a computer. And I liked that. You know, so, and then I'll say one last thing too, is that the interesting thing about a typewriter, of course, is that you can't magically erase what you've typed, right? Yeah. It's not like there's a delete button. The record of your effort, the record of your thinking is right there on the page all the time. And so you can really appreciate, you know, how difficult it is to write, you know, and how time consuming it is to write. And I find that to be a little bit validating sometimes.
Yeah. And it's even different from like handwriting your story, where you can go back and just quickly scratch something out or use an arrow to point to something. It's very different with the typewriter and certainly very different with a manual typewriter. So I really appreciate this idea, but it's making me think about, we're in this moment when artificial intelligence can do so many things and can generate language instantly. I mean, instantly. What do you think is, this is just a terrible question, but what do you think is just so uniquely human about writing, about typing even on a manual typewriter?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's no way that AI is going to, there's never. No way that ChatGPT or Claude can infiltrate my typewriters.
Never.
You know? I can be really assured of that. You know, there's no way. I mean, other things might, you know, I mean, if the typewriter has memories, for example, you know, sure. Like maybe, you know, computer has memories. So if the typewriter has some kind of, you know, mechanical memory, maybe that's, you know, part of what the writing process becomes. I don't know. I'm kind of just kidding there. But the first story actually in the collection plays with some of these ideas, you yes. know, that the memory, that the typewriters have memories and that the memories shape what it is that she's writing. And she, at one point, the protagonist, the typing lady, wonders if there's some kind of, you know, living organ inside the typewriter, you know, like an algorithm in an AI language, yes. you know, large language system, if there's some sort of organ in the typewriter that is, you know, that is sort of influencing the way that she writes. So, I mean, I kind of think about these things and I play around with them, but, you know, the mechanical nature of the typewriter too, is something that that I really love. I mean, I can fix it. You know, I can fix a typewriter. Me, you know, I can't fix a computer, but I can fix a typewriter because it is mechanical, you know. So I think that makes it human as well.
Oh, and anybody who has not yet read this story must read the story. I'm not going to spoil it because I want people to find the story and be moved to tears in exactly the same way that I was, in exactly the part that you're mentioning. Let me ask you about the story Immortal.
Yeah.
You include this idea about pica.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't think I've ever read a short story, and I read a lot of short stories. I don't know that I've ever read a story that mentions this, that includes this condition. It's not often seen, I don't think, in fiction. What is this about? What did writing about this allow you to show us in this story?
It was an interesting story to write about. You know, initially, the story was really about a kid who eats plastics. You know, and I wrote this, I think I started this at a time before I had a concept for The Typing Lady as, you know, a collection of short stories. Yeah. This was a story that I wrote, you know, before I even thought of, you know, of making a collection, never mind calling it The Typing Lady. But it started this, you know, this same way. You know, people say I have a disorder. The medical name for it is pica, which is Latin for magpie, because magpies eat anything. You know, and then the character goes on to say, but I don't. I only eat plastic. It was this idea of a kid who has this, you know, has this kind of need to eat plastic. And a friend of mine, I think I wrote it in response to a friend who was making an art, Marina Zirkow, who's an American artist, who was making a artwork around plastics. And so that was the inspiration for it. I didn't realize, I didn't know about pica until, and I didn't realize that, you know, I hadn't kind of made the comment, the connection between pica and the font. The, you know, the typewriter font, yeah. Pica, until quite a bit later on. So that was just a kind of nice little congruence that happened. But yeah, no, it was really a voice driven piece, you know, and I had this sense of this boy who had this attraction to chewing on plastic, and it just kind of got out of control. I mean, I don't know whether you did this or whether this was something that we did as children, but we used to chew on the tip on the on Bic pens.
Oh yes,
right, right, and there was that little plug at the end of the Bic pen, and we used to chew on those and kind of flatten them out, and you know there were all sorts of, I don't know why we did this, but you know there were always, you know, some kid in the class was always getting into trouble because they would get Bic pen ink on their mouth, right? And so I think it was that image that kind of set me off to write this. But I mean, of course, you know, the story is also, you know, in the background of the story, and the reason I wrote it, and the reason that, you know, that my friend Marina was doing art about this is because of microplastics in the environment, right? That we are all eating plastic now, right? And that's one of the things that sort of comes out in the story.
That's so interesting to hear you talk about that Bic pen. We all did that with our bottom teeth. You know, we would just like,
right,
like get that little stub out of there. So right. Bic pens and manual typewriters. Whoa.
Right. I mean, there was this is ridiculous, but you know, there was a way that you could kind of take that end of the Bic pen and suck the air out so that it would form a little vacuum that, and would then make the tip, you know, the stick to your tongue. I remember.
That is so true. Right. Oh my gosh.
Oh God, I know.
I love it.
Well, kids, you know, have done this throughout this, you know, ever since Bic pens were invented, kids
yes,
have been doing it.
So yeah. True. Well, earlier you mentioned the idea of loss, and I love talking about short stories and this idea of loss. As you know, Frank O'Connor wrote about how all stories are about loss in The Lonely Voice. And yeah. There's something about your stories here where there's this kind of exploration of the space between the life that somebody wanted or imagined or thought they would end up living and then what actually happens. It's a tension in the stories, just like it can be a tension for us, maybe most especially at certain stage of our lives. Mm-hmm. It's just such a fascinating idea that's running through the stories, even with much younger characters. I mean, there are characters of all ages. We're in all sorts of geographic spaces here. But the idea of loss and the way that it recurs is so interesting to me. And of course, it's different in every story, but it's also very resonant in it from every story as well. So I wonder if you can talk a little bit about how, as somebody who's written novels, and I know you've written stories for a long time, but this is your first story collection, how you encountered this idea about loss sort of repeatedly going through putting this collection together. How did that work out for you?
Well, you know, it's funny because I didn't realize what the collection was about. I never know what I'm writing about until some reader tells me, you know.
Yes.
And in this case, I had a bunch of stories that I was thinking of putting into a collection, and I sent this manuscript to my friend Karen Joy Fowler, the author of Booth and We Are All Completely Beside Ourselves, Jane Austen Book Club. Mm-hmm. And she's a dear friend of mine and a very generous reader. And I sent it to her and I said, so what are these stories about? And she wrote back and told me that, you know, that they're about writers contending with loss, right? And so that was when I realized, oh, you know, of course, she's right. She's always right. And that's when I started to go back into the stories and kind of draw out those themes a little bit more. But it was not something that I planned intentionally from the beginning. The stories seemed to, you know, emerge that way. I think part of it is, you know, is just that, well, I just turned 70. And although this is my, you know, this is my debut story collection, it's so great to be debuting something,
yes,
anything at the age of 70, right? So even though this is my debut story collection, you know, by the time you're 70, you've experienced a lot of loss, right?
Yeah.
And much of it is, you know, unexpected, because loss always feels unexpected, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. It never, you know, you can't imagine what loss feels like until you're in the throes of it. So I think that that, too, is really interesting. So I think that a lot of that is just coming from the stage of life that I'm at, kind of looking back through my life and realizing that those key moments of life, moments of loss, are actually some of the most profound moments of my life, that they're, you know, the moments where I've learned the most or where I've grown the most. So they're not just sad moments at all. They're generative, you know, in a way, looking back on it, kind of exciting moments where, you know, where I have feel like I've changed in some way, that I've used that loss and fashioned it into something and made something meaningful out of it. So even though, I mean, loss sounds so, you know, kind of like a real downer, you know, and it is, you know, it causes a lot of suffering, but at the same time, you know, it can be more than that, I think. And that's where this idea, you know, the idea of creativity comes in. If you treat loss creatively, it can become something meaningful.
I like this idea, and I like thinking about loss as the search for something or finding something you didn't know was missing,
yeah,
and it feels less sad or less burdensome,
yeah,
that way. And I do think about life as being a series of these kinds of realizations of what was missing or what you didn't know you should have been looking for. Or,
yeah, exactly.
You know. And there's,
yeah,
so much about this in your stories that I really appreciate. So if this is your debut collection,
yeah,
how do you feel about writing stories? I know you've written stories over a long period of time, but this happens to be your first published collection of stories, but do you love it?
I do love it. How did you know? I do.
I figured.
Yeah, I really do love it. I didn't expect to love it this much. I started really thinking about this short story form seriously when I started teaching, undergrad, you know, creative writing on an undergraduate level. And because of the constraints of the semester and, you know, the students are so busy, you know, trying to teach novel writing is really too much. And so, of course, we were limited to the short story, and that was fine. But, you know, I realized that I had to, one, you know, study up on the short story form, and that, two, that I should really practice what I preach. And so that's when I started writing stories, you know, more regularly, more frequently, so that I could experience the writing of it in a way that would help me teach it better. And, you know, to my amazement, I really, really liked the form. There's something about a short story that it's very different, very, very different from writing a novel. And there's something very beautiful about the form itself. They're compressed in a beautiful way. They're compressed and polished in a really beautiful way. So I'm you know, intrigued by this, and I'm hoping that I will write more short stories. And I'm also hoping that you know, that my novels can you know, not that I want them to be, you know, simpler or anything like that, but I would like to write shorter novels, because I think that people's attention spans now, my attention span, but, you know, people's attention spans now are really challenged. And I find myself really enjoying shorter novels these days. And, you know, to be honest, I mean, at the age of 70, you know, I still have several novels that I want to write, right? So yeah. Short seems pragmatic to me.
Yeah. So I was thinking about how, you know, so often people will say to me that they want to read novels, that they want to read long novels. And, you know, they ask me why I love short stories so much. But I always think about how the small moments against the backdrop of, some, you know, a longer story. That's something that I really appreciate. But mm-hmm. I was wondering if you're, because you are Buddhist, mm-hmm. I wondered about this idea of short stories seeming well suited for you, because they capture that compression. They translate that compression or the fleeting moments. And there's this kind of connection with like an impermanence or something. Maybe I'm overthinking it, but I'm trying to connect some dots.
I think that's fascinating, and I've never thought of it before, but I think you're probably right. There's a reason why the Buddhist, you know, in the Buddhists in the past, right, the all of the Buddhist ancestors, you know, of the past were poets, right? They why their poems, you know, in Japan, certainly, why the haiku, poem, that form, very short, three lines, you know, three lines of five syllables, seven syllables, and five syllables, right, was the preferred form for many Zen, you know, Buddhist poets. There's something about the story being able to kind of capture the moment, you know, the flash of, you know, an enlightenment moment, for example, right? Yeah. This little tiny poem, you know, sort of captures a moment that is, you know, that is kind of radical and liberatory, right, in some mm-hmm. way. And I think that's really interesting. You know, when I was a kid, because I was Japanese, and I loved to read novels, but I didn't think I was really entitled to write them. I remember I tried to write haiku, and it didn't really do anything for me when I was little. But I think maybe, you know, I might be, you know, kind of gradually coming back to that, to a kind of a briefer, as you say, kind of the moment, right? That key telling moment. Honing in on that you know, with more focus. I like that. I like that. I'll need to think about that some more.
When readers finish this collection, what is it that you want them to feel? What is it that you hope lingers for them for a longer period of time mm-hmm. once they've closed the book?
I would like them to feel that it was written for them. I would like a reader to feel that the book was written specifically for that reader. That would make me happy.
Ruth Ozeki, thank you so much. What an honor to get to talk to you. Thank you so much for your time.
This was really fun. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
Ruth Ozeki is the author of the story collection, The Typing Lady, and other fictions. This has been Book Public from Texas Public Radio. Jacob Rosati composed our theme music. Dan Katz is Texas Public Radio's news director. I'm Yvette Benavides.